Riddle, and this is the Nat Life Pod, a platform for conversation to help close the gap between wellness as an industry and wellness as a state of being. This week, our extraordinary guest with the name Kieran Lowe, or to those that know him, K-Flow. Kieran was an ex-international rugby player playing for Scotland. Before that, his clubs, London Irish, Glasgow Warriors, and the Saracens. Amazing backstory, trials and tribulations. We unpack all the way back to his very first day playing rugby as a 9-year-old through to his international level of rugby and the practices that have helped rescue him since those days of receiving head trauma. It's a phenomenal story that Kieran unpacks. So much wealth in there, so much depth. I really hope you love this conversation. There's so much in it for you, for every one of us, to understand that even in the dark times, we can find the light and shine a light for others. Mr. Kieran Lowe.
Mr. Tony Riddle.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Great to have you here, man.
Great to be
Thanks for making the long drive.
It's all right.
It was okay?
It's okay.
That's good to hear, man. It's great seeing your smiley face in the morning. It's great seeing you sitting with Bowman in the morning, him looking up.
It's nice to be around the Riddle kids, must admit.
Yeah. It's nourishing, right?
It's something that you mentioned on the coaching course.
Yeah.
I can't remember who you were talking about, but you said that he was sitting with tribal people, and he said that just sitting next to them made him realise how much of a mask he had on.
Ah, Bruce Parry. Right. Bruce Parry, yeah, sitting with the, I think it's the Benjeli tribe he mentions. And he's done a lot of work, considering himself to have done a lot of work in the spiritual realm, let's say. And yet he found himself sitting with these tribes people that are in this, well, the permanent state of being rather than the permanent state of making do.
Mm-hmm.
And how he suddenly found himself wearing masks.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
That's why I get run around your kids.
Amazing.
It's quite not like, yeah. Representation of yourself and sort of proof of concept when you're around them, it's like, okay, they're obviously being brought up different to the norm, right? And
well, it depends what norm we look at, right?
I mean, like societal norms
that,
they're very mature, right? But they're also children. And there's obviously the range of ages. And yeah, fascinating to be around. And it's a part of the experiences of coming to your, I mean, the man-men or the coaching is your family being here. It's not just you, it's you and your family, which has a huge impact on everyone. It's we all see you and on Instagram and through that lens most of the time, but actually to see you doing your day-to-day living is, that's quite a profound thing. And probably for me, the most inspiring thing, if I'm honest.
Well, it's real life,
not
15 second, 30 second, 90 second captures in a story of that or a reel, you know, is real. It's quite extraordinary with the kids. And it's also when I do hold space here, there is a part of me that feels, we have the kids here, you know, and not in a negative way, in a positive way, is that they're seeing that being normalized. They're seeing men sitting in a circle at Man Men. They're seeing extraordinary people from wherever kind of their background being sitting in a circle sharing. They see on the coaches weekend, the dynamics of that they're witnessing, like Tallulah at the age of 6 sitting in a cacao ceremony.
I was about to say that, right?
Completely at peace with being in the cacao ceremony.
Yeah.
Didn't speak, honored the ceremony, understand that's what it is, and sat cross-legged inside my cross legs, supping her cacao, you know?
And they got to witness everything that went on in that. It's always a powerful ceremony of Jeff, right?
Yeah, Jeff is extraordinary, right? So what a great first ceremony for Tallulah to sit in that as well.
To be around.
Yeah.
Very cool.
I mean, they drift in and out of everything we're doing, but to actually sit in a circle like that is really quite profound, right?
Mm-hmm.
Great template. Millie was gutted because she had no idea what was going on. I wanted to sit in that circle. So I think they come into the 100 human experience and they want to sit in Jeff's cacao ceremony there.
That's so important, you know? And I think for the like cultural shift of, I think we obviously you have to guard children and safeguard them to an extent, but also if it's in a safe environment, let them be there, let them be themselves, and it's like the part of the community, right?
Yeah, I think it comes down to this, what the social norms are, yeah. What we're guarding them from, right? Yeah. So if they're natural norms, how much guarding do we need? Mm-hmm. And if we're leading a life that's more aligned with a natural lifestyle, then they're really just learning through the observations, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the key to it, right? That's the key to changing, being the change, is the next generation's perhaps observing those behaviours.
I think that's where I'm coming at with my sort of way of thinking. It's always been a little bit, I guess when I was younger, it would be, I wanted to do everything for myself, for an individual pursuit of whatever, even just to get better every day. Then the older I get, it's actually, how do you make a difference in the world? Mm. And it is by showing up and be that, I guess with the words being used in that book, the mature masculine around children, and showing up and being a positive role model there. I think I've always had a bit of a resistance to leadership in my younger years, and maybe with the overwhelm of it and being thrust into leadership positions that I wasn't necessarily comfortable in. But then when I think about leadership now, it's changed, and it's actually just showing up as a good man, a good person, and embodying that and allowing young ones to see that.
How you lead yourself. That's leadership, right? Mm. How you lead yourself, what your values are, what your beliefs are, and how you transmit that in a way.
That's been one of the biggest learnings for me in our sort of journey, is actually, who do I want to be? What do I want to be? And we talk about like stepping into my power quite a lot recently in the coaching course and the men circle. And for me, stepping in my power is accepting all the good bits that have always been quite difficult for me to process. Definitely had this, I've got this story and this narrative of success in eyes of many. But I've always felt somewhat insecure around the leadership aspect of it all. And I think just on a physical level, because I'm a large man and people look up to me physically, sometimes I'm put into that role. And I always sort of have done. Like at school, I was, you're going to be the captain of that rugby team.
Mm.
That my first...
So it's thrust on you at that stage.
Absolutely.
And perhaps without the observation yourself of what that looks like or the skills within
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. I wasn't initiated into any of that. It was just, this is what you should do. And I felt complete overwhelm. And I mean, that leads into all the stuff of me speaking in front of people and self-soothing because I was overwhelmed with everything that was going on, there's a lot to go, lot to happen in when I was 18 to 25. There was just a period of my life which was a bit mad.
There's also where you are now
compared
to where you are back then, right? That's quite a profound shift. And again, you said already, like proof of concept, you know, of where you are today versus where you were back then. Mm-hmm. So should we go back there? Should we have a little dig around?
What do you want to know, mate?
I guess where you felt you were thrust into those positions and what unraveled from there. First day, first time playing rugby.
Whatever, or in a professional setting?
Ever.
First day ever, I mean, I was 9. I probably don't remember the day, but I remember the feelings of it. I'm from a somewhat emotionally unattached family. Loving family, amazing family, but not cuddly, feely. We don't do the normal. Not so tactile, that's the word. And I got invited to Chichester Rugby Club for a friend of mine at primary school. I was a very large kid, quite big, not fat, but just large and very tall. There was no athleticism in my family, really. There was no sports players. And I got taken to Sunday rugby. And I was high energy, so it just felt like that should work. Got a ball put in my hand. Didn't have a clue what was going on. Ran forward. Scored a try. And I did. There's celebrations everywhere. All these people that I didn't really know came around and embraced me and hugged me. And I just remember this feeling of like complete overwhelm and like, wow, what is this? Mm. Also just almost emotion. I remember feeling in the years after that, say before my teenage years, even maybe into my teenage years, actually getting overwhelmed with, I'm going to cry. Like, I'm so happy with what's going on right now. Like, I've been searching. This is only in observations of like digging into it, but like, I was definitely longing for that physical contact and that like admiration from someone.
The emotions that weren't felt.
Yeah, absolutely. And they were so overwhelming when I was younger. I would score a try and then have to run off because I would like be teary. But that was like the fire in my belly to keep pursuing it because I wanted that feeling. I liked that emotion. So when I was 12, England won the World Cup in rugby, and that was quite a big thing in my consciousness. As a young boy, just went to a rugby club and became part of a team for the first time and felt like I was part of something bigger.
In the community of it.
Absolutely. So I've had a community for the first time outside my family, which is fairly small. And then England won the World Cup. I watched Johnny Wilkinson kick the winning drop goal in Chester Rugby Club. I can remember it. I can see it in my mind's eye. And it was just eruption of huge emotion. And I was around all these new friends and adults that I'd respected. And they were watching on the screen England versus Australia. And it was 2003, November. And I was just completely in awe of it all.
Did you have a moment of, what would that feel like?
That's it. So I scored that try on the little minis rugby pitch outside.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know that feeling. And I'm seeing it play out on the screen and TV with the world watching in Australia. And I'm just going, I know that feeling and I want that feeling. And like when I think about it now, we talk about, I mean, my journey into the spiritual side of things, I've always been quite a logical, analytical person and I never particularly was in that way of thinking. But when I'm thinking about now, I'm like, I manifested my reality. Like this, I used to daydream of that. That was all I used to think about. I was obsessed with rugby.
Also driven by that, those first sensations of what that emotion is, because we... Yeah. Often forget the power of emotion mm-hmm. and what emotion can drive. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, so visualizing yourself in that moment with that emotion behind it is incredibly powerful.
I would absolutely put myself into it. I love reading, love watching movies as a kid, always done that. And so many of that is the hero's journey. So we will put ourselves into the hero's spot. Mm. And for me at the time, the hero was the rugby player. The person on that screen that I was watching on that day with all that emotion. And I mean, 10 years to the day after that, 2013 November, I played against Australia in Murrayfield for the wrong, I say wrong, I'm doing bunny ears, wrong country. It felt like the wrong country, but I mean, I was playing international rugby for Scotland against Australia. And it was, I mean, I was 22 and it was hard to process. I don't think I could process it at the time. I was just in the moment.
Well, you're thrust into it, really, aren't
completely.
You?
Completely. Like, and it all happened so quickly. Like, when I've had to go back and journal and I've done therapy and I've get my timeline together. And I didn't really realize that there was a period of 3 months from September till November where my life just completely changed. It switched on.
We're talking a 3-month window.
Absolutely. And it was the...
Because we hear about that in the world of music, right?
Is it?
You know, with these... Suddenly you've got these kids that are just jamming or busking and then they're thrust into these huge worlds of music.
Okay, yeah.
And then what happens, you know?
How do you deal with it?
And they sometimes have very short-lived careers mm-hmm. because they're so overwhelmed mm-hmm. and then it means that they're using and abusing mm-hmm. and everything else to be able to get back out there on stage in front of thousands and thousands of people that no one's given them really the time of day to give them the skill sets, right?
Absolutely, I can resonate with that. It was... thrust into that. So it was September of the 2013. So September, October, November. September, I played my first team game. I started my first team game for London Irish, which was the team I was at for 6 years. And I'd gone through the academy and played for England under 18s, under 19s, under 20s, was sort of slowly progressing. And then that season came around, the 2013-2014 season, and I was starting in the double header at Twickenham. So Twickenham's the home of English rugby. where all my favourite players have played watching as I grew up. And now all of a sudden I'm going to go play in that stadium, which is hard to fathom. And I'm 22.
Where the dreams are made and your dreams being made.
Right. And then I'm there playing against Saracens. And just before half time, ball pops out to me. And I just do what I instinctively know what to do. I run forward. And the gap opens up and I run through and I score at Twickenham. And the whole world to me is watching that. Like everyone I know is watching that.
We're not just talking mum, dad now.
Well, actually, my dad wasn't watching it because he went to the bar because it was just before half time and he wanted to get into the bar early to get a beer. And he told me since that he's at the bar and he heard the stadium erupt. He's like, oh, what's going on? London Irish has scored. Who scored? Kieran Lowe. And my dad's just getting it going, like silently. Very proud.
Yeah, I bet.
But yeah, it's good. And when I think about that moment now, it's
I bet that was his best pint ever.
Probably. He'll never tell me how proud he was, but it was I mean, he does it in his own way. But yeah, it's like I almost refer to it as time traveling now. Like I can, it's hard to explain. I've written about it at length. I've tried to think about that moment and what it was. Obviously it was maybe, I don't know, 10, 20 seconds, but it's in my consciousness and then will always be there forever of this palpable energy of, I don't know how many it was, 60,000 people just all screaming. And that feeling I had as a child, as a 9-year-old scoring on a little field in Chichester, all of a sudden it was just... Oof.
Trumped by 60,000 people.
And it's the best drug I've ever had. Like that is...
Straight in the vein.
Chasing it forever after that. And then the eyes are on me. I'm the somewhat young, upcoming rugby player and I just scored at Twickenham, so I've got a bit of credit. And then I had aspirations to play for England. Absolutely. I played for England under 20s with a... I can name drop a lot with my England under 20s team. If anyone knows rugby, it's like the very good rugby players are in it. It's the Owen Farrells, the George Fords, the Manu Tuilagis, the Vunipolo brothers. It was a star-studded team and I was part of the under 20s team. And I wanted to progress absolutely to England, but then Scotland came a calling. They found out I had a Scottish grandfather.
Yeah, I was going to go there. How did that work out?
So my granddad, Jock.
Perfect name.
Well, that's his nickname, right? What's his actual name? Wilfred, I think. On my dad's side, my dad's dad's a Scottish, and the head of the Scottish rugby at the time was an Australian fellow who was friends with my head coach at London Irish. They got speaking, found out I had a Scottish granddad, came down to the training ground in Sunbury where London Irish trained and sat me down and asked if I wanted to play. And I'm just sitting there like, international rugby,
what the fuck, what's like, there to answer?
Like I've had people ask me now, like, how did you make that decision? I was like, it was no decision to make. I was given an opportunity to live out a childhood dream and I did it. And I mean, when I asked, like, who are we playing in the autumn? Australia. I was just like, well, that all makes sense, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I went up to Scotland in I think it must have been in October or November, maybe. I broke my rib in the October. So there's a whole storyline parallel to this one. So September I score at Twickenham. November I make my test debut against Australia in Murrayfield at night, which is just an amazing thing in Edinburgh. In October I actually snapped my rib playing against Harlequins. And that was the first time I got given high strength pharmaceutical medicine. So codeine, tramadol, diazepam, zopiclone, and wasn't really told about what it was.
What the effects would be.
It's given it by a doctor of, you know, someone in the community that we trust. And
let's get him out there.
This is, you know, you have to rest up, take these pills, and you get you right because you're playing in November. We've got to get you right for that. So I went through that. And if I'm honest, I was overwhelmed. That was where the starting of like the big overwhelm came in. Like the eyes being on me and being from a somewhat... I was never really meant to be doing what I was doing. I don't like to label it, but rugby's a bit more of a middle class. I don't like those labels, but they go to private school and they're part of a machine that churns out these rugby players. I was not that. I went to a state school and came from a family of non-sports people, and it was just completely foreign. And then all of a sudden, I was just in this world. Eyes are on me. And I mean, the drinking culture in rugby is a pretty big thing. So
it's got lots of similarities to the military in a way.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many similarities. Mm. I've spoken to so many ex-military since leaving, and the institution of it all, and the mental health stuff that we suffer with and
endure,
the loss of identity when you leave, it's huge. It's funny to think about. But then, so I started drinking quite a lot, and that was something that I was.
So this is it. This the drinking's in the period where you're dealing with rib injury.
Mm.
Yeah.
So I started,
comes in there.
Absolutely.
So that's at the stage you're wounded in a way, right?
So wounded and not sure what to do, completely overwhelmed with it all.
Is this your first time wounded?
I've had injuries beforehand. I snapped my ankle, and it was a chance for me to get in the gym and get big. So it actually turned out like a positive.
Yeah.
But the rib was a different one. I couldn't move. And I was just basically getting high on pain meds on my own. And then also having the anxiety of, I need to show up in November to do this thing.
There's so much more on you at this stage, right?
So much more pressure. And I got through, they injected something into my rib. I think it was called prolotherapy. I don't really know what it was, but it was like a sugar solution. They injected it into my rib and it healed in the wrong place, healed quickly. And I was back for the autumn in November. And I went out onto the field, and I'd been drinking a lot for the last month. I'd been taking pain meds a lot. I'd probably taken pain meds to get out into the field. So when you think about a consciousness.
Well, you think about skills. A skill has a technical, physiological, and a mind, right? So the physiology's been impacted. You can rely on your technique because it's refined, but your physiology is compromised and the mind is compromised because you're medicated, right?
And
so the skill is
completely
compromised.
That. Absolutely. And my skill of, you can roll with the punches in rugby. You can get on a weak shoulder and not, you could do it the right way. And I was probably doing it the wrong way because my mind was
medicated,
absolutely medicated. And I've always had in rugby, it's like the warrior mentality, just get in there and get in there and get it started. And I would always know, I didn't know probably the physiology of it at the time. But once I got that through that initial bit of physical contact, my adrenaline and all the chemicals in my body would overtake me, and I wouldn't feel pain for the rest of the game. So it was just go and search for that first contact, and then you're free to do what you need to do. And in that, in my first contact, I took a very, probably not the best line, and I didn't use my footwork. I just ran straight into
not alert.
Two big Australian fellas and my consciousness knocked out of me, basically. And then that was, I mean, I've had a huge trauma release in one of your sessions in this room, actually, when I was crying my eyes out, and it was how scared I was in that moment. But not allowed to show it. I'd just been...
Well, you haven't shown it then for... That wasn't so long ago in this room.
Oh, that's when it came out.
You know, so it's had a lid on that length of time, right?
Literally. And it's been there from that moment. I feel emotional talking about it. It's because you're very aware of a lot still. I know that. And it's my ego in there just going, I cannot come off this field. I can't go off. I've just been hit so hard that I can't remember where I am. I don't know who I am. I don't know what's going on for like an instant, right?
But I know the whole world is watching me.
I know that I'm right. I know I've been watched, and I can't go off the field. And my whole world is just, it's hard to explain what it was, but I just went into autopilot because I've been this rugby player since I was 9, and I was 22 then, and I could just go into autopilot. And I was very good at that. I could just go through the motions. And so I started going into, and I've seen the footage since, and I'm just in that autopilot. I'm going through it. And actually, I think maybe 10 minutes later, I get another carry, I get tackled, and my head just hits the floor, and I get another concussion, and then I forget everything. I'm part of the line out in rugby, which is quite a orchestrated dance, essentially. Like, it's very well choreographed, and someone has to go up in the air, and it's quite a difficult thing to do. And I was part of that because I'm built well to go up in the air and take balls above my head. And I since watching the video, I basically got told not be in the line out and just stand outside of it because I was so not there. Yeah, it's a fascinating one for me because I'm watching it back. I can see what was going on. No one else could see what was going on. I hadn't told anyone how bad it was.
Well, you're in pure survival.
Complete survival. And then the game finished. We lost the game and my sort of consciousness came back to me when I was walking around Murrayfield Stadium, just like, okay, I know where I am. I know what's going on. And then a bit of an internal panic attack that I didn't feel like I could express. I was very scared, very emotional, very feeling wounded. Got put on oxygen by the doctor. I got told not to drink that night. I don't remember my capping ceremony. So your first cap that you get, I don't remember it. And then I got back to my hotel room and my head was dark. It was, I didn't want to be there, didn't want to be doing this.
Well, you're on your own at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that alone is shocking, right? You think about it.
Absolutely.
You know, and from the team really witnessing it, seeing it, and allowing you to be on your own is shocking.
In a hotel room with access to pain meds.
Yeah. And
I don't think I drank, I don't think I did. But it was the start of a spiral of, I didn't even know what mental health was at that point until stuff just started going wrong. I just wasn't me. I was scared of what I used to do. I felt like I was invincible until that moment probably. Mm. And then I wasn't. And now every time I was, you have hundreds of contacts a game. Every time I was going into that, I was scared, and that would fraction second off. It's
a lot.
It's huge, and it's a controlled car crash rugby, right? And you have to be really in it. You have to be very
alert. On point.
And I wasn't. And
precise.
It was the beginning of the end, pretty much. We got there pretty quickly, but yeah, that was a difficult time. And then between them and 2015, I was a shell of my former self, sort of just pretending and showing up to be an international rugby player. I'm still getting away with it, but self-soothing, self-medicating, the shadow coming out, all of it, booze, pain meds, gambling, women, just losing myself in the city. And so eventually, I just wanted out, really.
Well, again, it's whatever you can do to pacify the pain in that moment, right?
Massive self-soothing, yeah.
It's... And I'm sure you're not alone.
That's why I think it's so important to talk about it.
Yeah.
Like, I know that there is other men out there, and not just rugby players, there's so many men that have gone through trauma and had physical pain because they're a testosterone-fueled young man. They've gone and done something and hurt themselves, and they pay the price mentally, but they don't know. They're not in tune with their mental health or their...
Or not in tune with their emotions to go, hold on a minute, this isn't right. Rather than just, oh, it's father language of, oh, it's only a graze.
Stiff upper lip.
You don't need to cry.
Yeah.
Just rub it off, you'll be fine.
Oh, that's been the big journey for me, like, to sit in it. I had to learn what the emotions were. I had to learn how to talk properly just to actually... That's what therapy is, right? Talking about your problems. But like, how do you do that if you don't have the words? How do you do
how
that?
How do you articulate that?
How do you articulate it? How do you... Like I said, I didn't know what the emotions were. I could feel the feelings in my body. And that's why I like physical practice so much now. Like the somatic release of, say, dancing, right? For me, it's just like, that's how I express. That's how I can express. Or working out or anything but that physical, that's easy for me to express. That's normalized for me. But the... talking aspect has been a real worked on thing. I can sit here now doing a podcast with you and feel comfortable, but that is in itself has been a learned process over years.
Well, again, you're really not alone in that. I had to do a lot of work. I had to do a lot of work to find voice. It's really evident in the men's work again that we do, but then it helps men in a circle to see others speaking and to be able to share, and then it's okay, that's okay, I can share that, or that resonates, or that connects with me, I can share that. And then it's, again, a learned thing. It's an observation. But again, where I think the where it gets blurred is, for us men, is we haven't observed. We have not had the observation. We don't have the template for it, you know?
Absolutely. Like rugby was, you maybe would get some emotion out on a drinking session, right? But it's such an unhealthy environment to...
Yeah, and almost how much is then when you wake up the next day is then, oh, I should have said that.
Yeah.
Oh, I never should have shared that. Yeah. And then that drives it and pushes it deeper into, I shouldn't be saying this and I shouldn't be sharing this.
I think that's why, I mean, the man for me has been the biggest shift in my consciousness. I feel like I've done a lot of work trying to figure out this thing. I mean, I have a, technically, right, from the doctor's point of view, traumatic brain injury, PTSD, post-concussion syndrome, depression, anxiety, all these things, impulsivity. I don't align myself with those labels. I don't like them. I'm just a human that has experienced this life and went through some things. And I believe that humans are resilient and we can heal. And the closer I live to nature and obviously connecting with your tribe and your philosophy, I found you because I saw a man online that was thinking how I thought. And I was like, I need to be around that. I need this community of people. Because at the time I was doing all these things to figure out it of the physiology. And I started to meditate and I started to go outside and started to understand the science of it all. But I was doing it alone.
Mm.
And it was like not the last because it's a journey, but connecting to like-minded individuals, and especially for me, men, has been a profound experience and so healing, it's hard to put into words. And sometimes it blows my mind. Like when Tom Johnson was on the Man Men.
Yeah. I've invited Tom on. He's coming on.
Please get him on.
Yeah, he's going to be on.
Because, like, I mean, sometimes when I think about my life and the stories, and it doesn't always necessarily, I can get overwhelmed with the idea of, like, is this, like, this has happened to me, right? This all has happened to me. I have done this and done this and done this and whatever. And then the universe just provides some stuff sometimes. And you're like, is this coincidence or is this meant to be? Like when Tom came, I was like, I recognize that.
Explain for the audience who Tom Johnson is.
Tom Johnson, it was a blindside. I played blindside flanker for London Irish for most of my career. Tom Johnson was he's an amazing rugby player and he played for Exeter Chiefs. He showed up to Man Men February, right?
Yep.
I was like, I recognize that guy. And I've been away from rugby for so long that it was like, I haven't been in that world. I haven't been watching it. I was like, I know this guy. I know who this is. And I knew that I knew him and I knew how I'd played against him, but I couldn't really piece it together. And then we didn't really get into the whole like swapping ego stories of rugby. It was like very much we were in the Man Men circle and we were present together.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was
Well, actually, you've been trying for all that time to remove yourself from it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was, so we didn't need to go there. We just were there as men. And we had an amazing weekend and there was some amazing sharing. And actually what you were saying earlier about Tom sharing of his story allowed me to share
so much more.
Yeah, and that's how it works. Like when you're around and you're comfortable and there's a safe space, that's where the healing happens. Because if you don't have it, you don't say it and you don't process it. But it was only towards the end of it was on the Sunday as we were leaving, and I just need to check like who he is and to make sure like I've got it right, because I know the name and knew the face. And then I started to go back into my memories of, right, so where was my first actual premiership game? My first premiership game was against Exeter down at Sandy Park. And I'd been there the day before with Matt from Man Men and ran, like, not randomly, but that's who I was getting lift down with. And he was at work that day. And I was like,
I was in Exeter.
And I was like, I don't know what to do. So all I'm going to do, I'm going to go walk. And I walked at Sandy Park and I was there just like, oh yeah, I remember. This is the first time I played premiership rugby. And sort of getting those memories coming up. Then the next day, turn up to Man Men Tom's there. I was like, that's a bit weird. And then after it all finished, I went onto online and checked London Irish versus Exeter on that game and the date, or tried to find out when it was, because I couldn't remember. It was like 2010, I think. See the team sheet, number 6 that day, Tom Johnson. I'd come on at number 6, and I'd literally been face-to-face with that man on my first premiership game. And then, I mean, then shift forward to the present. I'm just releasing all this emotion.
Sitting opposite him.
I was like, this is all just meant to be. Like,
science will call that coincidence.
Yeah, but it's some stuff you can't explain in life, right?
Yeah, I think it's the sharing part of those man-men circles. I think it weren't any men's circle experience, because when we see, I guess, the Instagram short stories or reels again that we unpacked earlier, most observe it as the hyper-masculinity of perhaps axe throwing or wrestling, or, you know, not that ice baths are hyper-masculinity, but they see it as that. Well, actually, we're not going to record what happens in a circle, but it's the circles that are the most powerful part. And the other practices are really about grounding us.
Yeah.
So we can feel grounded in a position, we can down-regulate, and so we no longer have all those, oh, I shouldn't really be doing this, I shouldn't really be doing that, no, I shouldn't say that, I shouldn't say this. And again, it's proof of concept, right, in all of those practices to be able to then sit and share like that.
Absolutely.
And that was massive. It was, like, what, 6 hours, I think, circle.
It was, and it was what was needed.
Yeah.
And we all showed up and took part. And say about the practices, it's all of it. It's actually, we've got the WhatsApp group, and we're allowed to speak in that, and that's like the precursor to a man-men, really, isn't it? It's like you feel safe in that. And then I guess for me, it was because it's been, I think, what, 3 years in Tribe? And you have to be comfortable around the people you want to talk to. You can't just start sharing stuff with random people. I mean, that's probably why people get drunk and express themselves in that way, because they don't
feel comfortable. Random people. Yeah.
Two literally random people. And it's like, you have to feel comfortable with it, and the space is being created. And obviously you've created the space, but it's actually everyone partaking in it creates that space.
A circle.
It's huge.
It's not a stage with an audience. It's a circle, right?
And I think that's where, if coming back to the leadership part, there's been an awareness around that for me in this area, because hyper-masculine stuff definitely been there. Rugby, hyper-masculine. I can view it as the modern day Coliseum, and we're the Warriors, right? And people look up to you.
Give them bread.
Right.
Yeah.
And
then we go and watch them.
Keep them entertained. Yeah. And then, so I'm aware of that. And being in that leadership role in that sort of hyper-masculine thing. And how healthy is this? Do I really want to be that? And then coming out of that and trying to figure out who I am, every part of me, and understanding that I'm not this hyper-masculine person. I can be. I can be all of it. But there's also the softer side and the more and the open and the vulnerable.
Well, I think what you're describing is the masculine, not the hyper-masculine.
Yeah. The mature masculine.
The hyper-masculine, again, is the unhealthy relationship of masculine, right?
Yeah. Because
the masculine is you can be all these things, and you can also be all these, what we class as what should be healthy feminine traits as well, right? Because we can equally have the unhealthy feminine, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And in that, it was at the 100 human experience where the awareness came. I felt, so I had another, I guess, trauma release in a breath work session, I think with Arthur. And 100 people there, didn't know all of them, I think maybe, yeah. And I don't do the Wim Hof breath, Tummo breath a lot, but when I do, it's like the setting's really good, and it brings about whatever is needed. I go into the different part of my brain and stuff comes up.
Mm.
What came out that day was tears. And I allowed myself, because of the safe space, to let them out. And that is a new thing it has been in my life, to allow those emotions to come out, and especially in a setting with 99 others, and just that feeling, and parking that thought in my head of like, no, it's embarrassing, like, that you can't do this, you have to stay strong, you're this hyper-masculine man. No, actually let it out, release it, and that's what I did, and probably still had those thoughts and feelings, but just allow myself to do it. And actually afterwards getting told by other men, because you cried, it allowed me to cry, and I haven't cried for 10 years. And hearing that for me at the time was like imposter syndrome. I was like, man, this almost puts like expectations on me. But then I dropped that and I was like, no, this is just what it's meant to be. We're allowed to be human. This is just the human experience. Like, we are emotional beings and we're crying together. And then we've also laughed together, and we've played, and we've moved, and we've done all of it.
Licked each other's cheeks.
All of that stuff, right? And then it's when you get outside of that mindset of like, oh, this is weird, this is uncomfortable, which I can really relate to. They've definitely been there in the first human experience. Like, oh, wow, I've got to, you know, look at someone in the eyes and tell them I love them. And then how profound that can be.
Mm, and then just that, even just gazing into someone else's eyes, right?
Even that. But that's like one of the big things. A lot of people will not look you in the eyes. And actually, I find from a bigger man's perspective, I have to be careful of it. Because if I do it too much, it's almost, they just shy away from it. And it's almost like I'm being a bit too, I don't know. I'm not trying to dominate you with my eye contact. I just like looking in your eyes. Do you know what I mean?
Looking down on you.
But yeah, I mean, that's how
they're receiving it.
Absolutely.
You know.
Absolutely. But without the experiences and the man-man circles, like, that's been the big shifts. Because I've been around people doing it. I haven't just been on my own in the mountains or like off wandering around. Like, oh, what's going on? How do I like address these emotions? Like, you can't do it on your own. We're tribal beings. We need community. And that was,
yeah, it's really affirming for me because, you know, underneath the 100 human experience is this. It's about, you know, getting people outside those limiting beliefs and behaviors and bringing them into something where, again, we're immersing in a human experience. You know?
People ask, what do you do on those weekends?
Yeah, we've had like, oh, it sounds like a cult. And it's like, but it's just getting 100 people together. And again, it can be complete strangers.
Yeah.
And we do get that. Is it okay to come on our own? Is it okay? Yeah, of course it is. You know, you'll really be connected to 99 others in a very short window of time.
Yeah.
With some very simple practices.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and that's what's quite profound.
It's so simple.
Because we think it's so, you know, to access bunny ears, the authentic being, or to strip away, or we think it's such a complex thing. It's a bit like, you know, discussing about wellness as an industry versus wellness as a state of being. It's actually very simple to drop into, you know. It doesn't cost a lot even to do that.
It's just free.
It's just drop in and, okay, if I play and I breathe and I move and I get into cold water and I have a hug, the power of the hug, right?
Absolutely.
Once I have all that, what, you're telling me I'm going to have this amazing state of well-being? Yes, it's that simple. It doesn't have to be that complicated, but yet we still want it to be that complicated. We consume vast amounts of information on the daily around wellness. But actually, how many are actually out there experiencing it and practicing what they've perhaps read or witnessed?
I think that's where my, I guess, so the warrior energy that I've had from my rugby days has led me into, okay, I've felt that on the 100 human experience. I knew that there was benefits there. So I fully immersed myself into it. I can't figure out exactly why this is working, but it's working. So I think maybe for some, they will go to a weekend and if they're not, they can be uncomfortable and then go away and then go back and try to analyze it and think about it and go off and whatever, not really immerse themselves in. But if you do the simple practices.
Integration.
You integrate into your life and you make them a habit and you make it actually who you are. That's where the shifts come. Like that's where you can change yourself. That's what I just want to.
You can change yourself in a breath, you know, and this is the thing about integration. We get to breath, right? But, you know, if you think how many books now on breath, how many podcasts discussing breath, how many breathing experts there are, it's huge at the moment.
Mm.
Yet how many are actually truly integrating those practices and being consistent and staying in it and having a real patience within the process and trust the process, respect it, be patient whilst in it until finally you figure out, oh, I am the process. I just have to be. And the being part is the actual really immersing in it, integrating it into your very being, you know? That's where the magic is. And it's giving stuff enough time and not going, oh, okay, I've tried that. I'm going to go and try this now. I'm going to try that after just a few days because it hasn't quite matched your expectations or perhaps the way that someone's been delivering it, you know? It's how it's being received, heard. But there is sitting with a practice and you're back to your rugby days, you'll know how long it takes to refine a skill, right? And to get it where it is. But you also know how quickly the saboteurs can come in that would affect the mind within it, the physiology in it, and all the technique within it. And then do I keep pursuing it? And it's like, just sometimes we just have to open another door. But actually, if we can take the practices within where we're feeling, there's something within that that I'm, that connects, or that word connects, or that happens, this happens. Okay, let me just stay with that. My morning meditations are have evolved somewhat over time, but everything that's worked, I'm still doing it, like years on. I'm still doing the same breathing pattern of 4-6 on the breathing app that I've mentioned probably in every single podcast right now. But there's a discipline within it, right?
Oh, yeah, consistency over time.
Every time.
And you have to build the habits, build the discipline. Yeah. And I'm very grateful that I've had that in my life from these previous experiences. And it's allowed me to, my intention is to embody my practice and to show up authentically as myself now. And that's a process in itself. Like I'm still in this world dealing with everything else everyone else is dealing with. But it's talking about, so say the breath, right?
Yeah.
And embodying that. And I'm now on this journey to become a breathwork coach. And I still have a huge amount of resistance to that. And I'm trying to unpack where that's coming from. I want to share this, my journey and my understanding of it, and I've gone deep into the physiology of it and the science of it, and I understand it, and my own practice is, it's changed my life hugely.
You've embodied the practice.
But in that, like embodying that, sometimes all I want to do is just downregulate and just breathe. Like the social media side of things and how you're meant to brand yourself and you're meant to be this person. It's like, I don't want any of that. Like, if you want to have a chat about the breath, come and have a chat with me and we can experience the breath together. I don't necessarily want to tell you how to do it. I just want to show you the right path to walk down.
The 20% input for the 80% output.
I'm still figuring it out. So, and then there's big resistance there, but it's one that I'm pushing through. It's, I know it's a worthwhile cause. As sometimes I can get overwhelmed with what you just said, but there's so many different opinions and, but I know what I feel, and I know the effect that it's had on me as a person, the down regulation of my nervous system, how to control that. And it's just like, actually, that's a profound thing in itself. And we don't have to complicate it. The simple thing is, from this brain injury and this living life and just in my adrenaline for so many years, my nervous system was upregulated,
jacked up.
And I was on the other side of it, not knowing that, I didn't have that understanding, didn't have an awareness. And then I've started to pay attention to my body. I noticed that my teeth were grinding at the back. And when I went to the dentist, they told me that. And I was like, why is that happening? Upregulated nervous system. You're in your fight or flight too much. What's the fight or flight? Okay, let's figure out this nervous system thing. Let's go and understand what that is. I learned this word yesterday in the book, precocious child. I'm that. Very curious, child. Very curious. Just wanted to know how things worked. So did that with the nervous system, and then I was like, okay, so your breath can have an effect on it. What do we have to do there? And then started this journey into the breath, and I've gone on all the different. I've looked at everything in the breath that I wanted to look at. I've been submerged in it for years, and I'm just very obsessed with it. I have an obsessive personality. I like that part of myself. I can get good at things quickly because I can be obsessed with them. Obviously, that can get dark sometimes if it's the wrong obsession. But with the breath, I'm just so intrigued by it. And I think, if I'm honest, Wim Hof's input into the consciousness of the world was a bit like...
A massive shift for many.
Huge. And I was like, what's this guy doing? Oh, he can affect his immune system and he can control his heartbeat. And I was like, I want to do that. So yeah, cool, let's go down that journey. But then it led me to it's not complicated. It's extend your exhale and relax your body, relax yourself and like calm down. I like going fast. I'm comfortable in it. I can be in that upregulated state and perform. I know how to do that. But my life is so much better and so much more pleasant if I'm downregulated and I've done my practices and I've calmed down and I don't have this rushing of energy and like overthinking mind, and I'm just present. And when I'm diligent with it, and which I am, because of who I am, life is just there to be lived, and the bad stuff's not even bad. It's just there for me to learn.
Yeah.
And the good stuff, I'm there present in it and I'm enjoying it. And it's just, it's life-changing, and sometimes I still can get overwhelmed with someone.
Well, it's beyond life-changing for you is appreciating that it's every life around us is impacted by that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every relationship around us improves from that.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. That's one of the reasons.
From a parenting perspective for me.
Yeah.
You know, if I start right in the morning and I'm down-regulated in the morning, yeah. I'm proactive.
Yeah.
If I allow myself to get upregulated and I go from one space that might be, I don't know, it could be a phone call, an email or whatever it is, something, if it came in triggering and I don't just sit afterwards and go, okay, let's just process this, let's breathe for a moment before entering the next room where Katerina and the kids might be, or let's say Bowman, right?
Yeah.
And they're like, and charge around the house, that's what it would sound like to me. If I downregulate, I walk in that room, I just see playful kids having an amazing experience at home. And it's like, that's how different it can be from just, it's the same kids in the same room, but what alters the perception is whether I'm seeing it through an upregulated lens or a downregulated lens.
Absolutely.
So that's how they're receiving me also, is through a downregulated lens or an upregulated lens, because my energy will change their energy and they then learn that template.
Mm-hmm.
That's...
No, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
And the ripples that are created from that.
The ripples.
I could only really enter back into the world by down-regulating my nervous system, because at that point I was becoming aware of myself and I'd been on this journey of meditation, but I was still up-regulated a lot. And I was aware of the effect I was having on others. In this up-regulation, there was self-soothing and addictions, and that has an effect on the people that love you.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also just how you react to people and what you're presenting. And I think the biggest one there was me and my dad were just butt heads.
Collisions.
And like, I had to downregulate myself to get away from this narrative that was destroying my family life and my friendships and being able to have authentic connections with people. Because I was this traumatized person and I'm hurt and I'm injured. And it's like,
and I have this armor.
Absolutely, big armor that I'd created over years, and it was a process in itself to take that off, but life changing to take it off.
But it's off now. Feels very much like it's off now.
It is off,
and it's a beautiful thing, right?
Yeah.
So where you are now? Because I'm often asked, you know, what could you say to your younger self and what would you change? I wouldn't change any of it because actually it's led me to the position I'm in today, to the person I am today. So within the whole rugby career, going all the way back to, let's say, that first boy on the pitch at the age of 9, then fast forward to the age of 12 and so on, do you appreciate the had to go through that moment of all of that?
I go, brain damage was the best thing that ever happened to me. Best thing that ever happened to me. It showed me who I was and how to, and the stuff I learned through the hell of that, and it was hell. I got taken to hell, in this unknowing of my brain's changed, and it did. It's been like, they scanned it and it's changed, right? But
which almost impacts it at that moment, seeing that.
Huge.
Drives it a bit deeper.
And I'm very,
in that moment.
Very glad that I didn't get diagnosed with this. I didn't get diagnosed with it until last year. Mm. And I had a period of hell, yes, but also still me with an imagination and a positive outlook on life. And I've started to observe changes in myself and I've gone, well, who's to say this can't be a bad thing?
Mm.
And I have... I'm diligent in what I do and how I want to be. And I'm very confident that we can have an impact on our health and how we think. And I'm never going to align as someone that's damaged. That's just not me. I've had this thing that happened to me. It happened for me. And I learned so much about the body and the mind within that. I'm now in a place where I don't feel there is no negative to this. My practice that I have are life-changing. The way I think is better than it was. Well, it's different. It's more healthy.
So let's unpack the simplicity of those practices.
Yeah.
You know? from going from that to where you are now, to be able to sit and appreciate it all happened for you, that you're not in the victim, oh, this has happened to me.
Yeah.
What are the simple practices?
So I underpin everything was with, I live to nature, mm-hmm. we are nature. So I try to align myself to that, understanding that we are just part of this. And then in simple terms, like you say, we can't all live in nature as much as I try. Like that is, I do try to be outside and be present within it. So I see a lot of people with headphones on walking around. Right? Like my biggest practice sometimes is just moving forward with my mouth shut in nature. And that's the best therapy I've ever had. I've done it at length all over the world. And it's led me back to myself. It allowed me to remember who I was. But I mean, shutting your mouth, breathing through your nose and moving forward. If it's up a mountain, that's really nice.
Mm.
But getting in the water for me, getting in the ocean, getting cold, feeling and experiencing this life that we have the opportunity to do every day and embracing it by being present in that moment. That's pretty simple.
Yeah.
You just have to...
Breathing, nature, cold water.
And then being around the right people.
And then being around the right people. And dancing.
Dancing. I mean, yeah, always. Moving your body.
You know, immersing in all of that.
Yeah, being present. It's...
Yeah, I think with all of those practices, we can't all live in nature, but it doesn't mean we can't live naturally. You do have to get into nature, I believe.
Yeah.
And then what that does, it drops you into understanding what it is to be in the moment, if you really allow your senses to be open to it. And then it also gives you this is what it feels like. So this stuff, the symptoms of me being disconnected from this, how much of this feeling right now and the experience I'm having, can I then bring into that everyday life of my experience?
That's been the integration for me, because the realization of that for me came a big time in the storyline would be like in a mountain in Nepal. And I was just there like, I've got all this stuff that I've been struggling with. I've been in hell. I've been experienced depression, anxiety, all these things. And then I was on this 6,000 meters up in the air in Nepal in a mountain, sleeping in a tent with like nothing. And I was just so happy and content and away from it. And I was like, there's nothing wrong with me. Like, I was just, when I'm around an upregulated society, it upregulates me. And then it's like, it has an effect.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, integrating myself back into society is, I have to be careful of how I do things. I can't just go and do the normal things. I don't want to go out drinking. I don't want to, I have to be careful with coffee, how much I drink coffee and stuff. Like, I have to be careful with the people that I'm around. Like, I don't go into the city that often. I try to drive as little as I can. I all these things that are socially normal, but biologically.
But they're socially normal, but biologically extreme.
And then the other way around.
But the behaviors are more often like walking barefoot or taking cold showers even, or breathing or sleeping without a bed on a floor, or removing your chairs, are perceived then as socially extreme, yet they are biological norms.
If I go and do the social norms, then I can become bad. Not bad, but like not myself, and I could be upregulated, and I can this narrative of, oh no, maybe you do have a brain injury, maybe you can't, like,
encourage maybe the stories,
you know what I mean? Up, it's like, when I'm actually present and there, none of that's there. I'm just me
in the moment,
and that's what I want to be.
So there we are. You know, it's quite easy to get to that heightened state. You know,
we live in it.
We live
most
in it.
Most people,
we are that. If we can just, again, breath, cold, nature. Yeah, I guess it's when we are in the funk, you know, when we do revisit that, and it's also removing kind of the guilt and the shame and everything else that comes with going, oh no, I've slipped up, oh no, this has happened to me again, and then thinking that that's now going to be the permanent state again.
Yeah,
you know,
that comes back to the circles.
Yeah.
You don't have those people to share that with, and you don't feel safe enough to express that, and you hide it from someone, then that can carry and that can snowball. But if you have a group of loving men around you or anything.
Well, there's accountability, right?
Accountability is needed. You can't do it on your own. Otherwise, and I've been there. When you're trying to do it on your own and there is no accountability, you think, yeah, well, what's the point? You're an imposter and your trickster will take over and will sabotage you until you almost lost yourself.
So, breathing, Kieran. Where are you with the coaching side of it now? Because you did the Nat Life Coach Cert, first time up there presenting.
Well, that amazing. It's a learning in itself, right? Because there's been the storyline that I've had attached to myself for so long that I wasn't comfortable public speaking because of this trauma as a child that I've unpacked over the years. Like standing up on stage, like so many people at school can mess up on and shut that part of themselves down. They don't feel, I lost my voice. That had a big impact on even on my rugby career. I used to be so scared of going in front of the camera, talking in front of people. I would be pushed into this spotlight and I just didn't know, my nervous system would be so jacked up from this trauma that I'd been held on to when I was a kid. And then I had the opportunity to actually talk in front of people and present on the breath, which is something I'm passionate about. And I'm just glad I've done it. Like I just needed to do
it.
I'm
glad you did it.
I just needed to do it. It wasn't perfect, but like, it was the first time I'd done it. And it was like, I can do that. And like, now I'm just like, okay, now I know what not to do. And I know what I want to do. And like now I went to an event this week and I was watching keynote speakers. And I'm just like, I'm envisioning myself doing that. Like I want to get up and tell my story to people. I think the sharing of our stories is huge.
Absolutely.
And the tools and techniques and the small little insights I've had from this journey, which is quite a unique one. I have to honor that. Like not many people, I mean, it's a small percentage of people that go and play international rugby. And there's a lot of good and there's a lot of bad and there's so much learning from it that the more I speak about it, the more I learn about myself. And actually I know that it can help people. And I have to honor that side of myself because sometimes I can step away from that and go, oh, no one needs to hear this.
Well, it's also honoring that maybe that's why I went through all of that to get to where I am now.
Yeah.
And then there's the helping of others through that process.
That's the process.
Every time we tell our story, you know, or a story, you know, or discuss anything from our past. Again, going back to the circle, something resonates, right? It can just be a word. Could be a full sentence, could be the whole conversation, but there's inspiration from that. Also gives the courage to others to sit and go, you know, I'm going to tell my story.
Absolutely. And that's needed just to speak it out. But yeah, the breath, man, it's, that's the journey that I'm on now and I'm enjoying it. But it's like, I don't need to overthink it. I don't need to live in the future and try to play. I want to be this. No, I'm just going to carry on showing up as my authentic self and I'm going to breathe. I'm going to breathe slowly on the exhale, most probably.
The difference is from where you are now to that first vision of seeing England playing to, I want to do that. To seeing someone at a keynote and going, I want to do that. And the modalities you have now in place to know, well, okay, before I go out and speak, this is what I do. You know?
Absolutely.
Which I do. I mean, look at the, what is it, Land's End, John O'Groats being thrust into that. Suddenly it was podcasts and press and TV. And again, no one gave me the tools. No one was like, this is what you're going to do before you go on there. And they just say, well, fill this form out. Do you want a tea? Oh, you don't look nervous. Have you done this before? You know, I've just been sitting with the, there we go. Another shout out to Eddie Stern's breathing app. I've just been using the breathing app for 5 minutes.
That's like a life-changing app, though, because it's a free app, right?
Honestly, it's just the most simplest thing. It's that easy. If you have problems getting up, speaking in front of an audience, if you have to go and get challenged with a phone call, or even it could be, I don't know, pay rise, or trying to change the role within your company or something that you find you're gulping down or getting flushed, is you just put that on. And it doesn't even have to be the boom, the sound of it. It has this disc that inflates, you know, expands and contracts, which represents the inhale and the exhale. 5 minutes, and that's all I was doing. And then I'd have 5 minutes on there. I was sitting down with Kay Burley from Sky News.
Yeah.
And I walk in, and I haven't got any shoes on, I'm barefoot, and I get up on the Sky News couch, and I sit cross-legged with my bare feet up, and first thing she just went, "You're so calm, your energy is so amazing to be around," you know? But walking through the entrance to Sky News and going through the building, there was a flutter of something, right? Yeah. Oh, wow, I'm going to be on the news. And then if I didn't sit and breathe, I would have gone in with that energy, and how well would have I articulated that message? And the message really was about personal and planetary health. It came with a huge message and was creating a huge platform from it. And I wouldn't have given any of that any justice, you know, had I been upregulated.
What do you think I was doing before I came, like, before on air? Like,
before we get behind the mics.
I had that, like, pre-game energy.
Yeah.
Because it's, like, excitement, but there is anxiety there. And yeah. It's just like, well, I know what to do. And, I mean, what would I tell my younger self? One of those practices, for sure.
Put the breathing app on.
Literally.
Kieran, get the breathing app. Yeah, but we don't have that tech yet.
I think it's too simple. It's oversimple for some people.
I know
they're
it is.
They're expecting you to tell them this magic thing. The magic thing is the breathing app, or just slowing your breath down. Mm. Like, all the breathing app is doing is, say the 4-6 is taking you down to 6 breaths per minute, and most people breathe twice that, if not more. Mm-hmm. I've seen people that go up to like 20 breaths per minute, and it's just like, and if you're doing it through your mouth, then you're hyperventilating and you're in your fight or flight because your physiology is, and then that is going to lead you to a worse headspace. So in order to think well and be who you are, speak from the heart, like, you have an effect on your physiology, and it starts with the breath. Well, that's the remote control of it. You have control over your breath. So learn to slow it down, and then from that, it will unravel. You may not get it straight away, but if you just start and consistency over time, and it's there and it's free, and you can do it every day. And that's my biggest practice. If I start the day there and end the day there, the middle bit's normally right.
It's we can't all breathe in nature, but it doesn't mean we can't breathe naturally, because that's one of those tools, right? I can't bring nature in. Like, there's amazing studies around nature and how it drops us into that same parasympathetic state. The visual field, open up your visual field, drops into parasympathetic state. Walking barefoot, getting grounded. Mm. Oh, incredible practices, and so simple. Mm. Yeah. My mornings, I'm going out now and I'm recording it for the audience just to demonstrate how simple this is. Barefoot, on the ground, grounded, nature in my ears, nature in my eyes, and breathing in and out through my nose. That's the simplest, but how much of that can I take into my everyday environments? Or if I was in the city, for instance, what I can do is breathe. And I've mentioned this in the past. It's like, if I go into London, I nasal breathe 4-6 tempo as I'm walking around. I slow everything down by 10%, my walk. And I make sure I can feel myself rolling through from my heel to my big toe when I'm walking. I stand tall, upright, lift head, lift chest, and think about the language, lead with the heart, Tony, not with the head. And it is, honestly, it's so profound, because I am the observer. I'm observing London and not swept away in the chaos of it. I don't get upregulated then as I'm walking around. I'm actually, it's somehow joyous, you know? There's a joy in it, because it's like, oh, well, this is because it's, I'm not in it the whole time. It's punctuated, and it could be in weird once, let's say if it's once a month. But it brings in, I remember when I was a kid and we were kind of reached an age where we'd go on the train, and we'd get the train into London.
Yeah.
And this, yo, we're going into London, that excitement of going. Rather than, oh, I've got to, I have to go into London, it brings in the I get to go into London language, right? Because there's a down regulation, there's a making peace, I think, with those environments and habitats, rather than seeing, vilifying them in a way.
Judging it. Because I've definitely been through that. Like, I'm like, oh, crap, I'm going to get overwhelmed because I'm going to London and it's an unnatural space. But like, if you do the practices, you know.
Yeah. Because London's like one massive ice bath.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I've got to get in the ice.
Yeah.
So it's like, what can I be doing? I can breathe again, and I can take that into any one of those environments.
For my best way to drop in is relax the pelvic floor, but also relax the face. And then it's because it's both ends of your spine, it relaxes out everything else in there. And then you're just sitting there with your diaphragm. And I think the resistance sometimes to breathing is how I get my understanding of my body and my physiology through to another person, because I've gone in and, okay, that slowly relaxed that muscle, whatever that muscle is, and that slowly relaxed, and now I'm breathing into that space. Mm, and
curiosity.
I'm really curious about what's going on. I've gone on that exploration, and I can put a heart rate thing on my finger, and I can watch my heart rate drop, and I can have control over that. And that's powerful. I have control over this body of mine, and that's such an empowering thing. But it came from practice, and it is the create the habits, be consistent with it, trust the process, respect the process, be patient within it,
and become it. Good place to finish that, Karen.
I think so.
Yeah, trust the process, respect the process, be patient whilst in the process.
It's top of my journal every day.
Yeah, until finally you figure it out that you are the process and just be. Thanks, brother.
Thank you very much.
There you go. Let's ching these together. Water.
Mm.
Thank you, man.
Thank you very much.
Beautiful.
Mm.
Let's have a hug.
Yes, please.
Oh, yeah. Have a hug, Robbie.
We got that one.
We breathe.
As always, I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you feel drawn to do so, then please subscribe to the show, leave a review, and don't forget to share. Sharing is caring. It really helps me to help others. If you're drawn to immersing yourself in any of the NatLife experiences or see yourself as a NatLife coach, head to tonyriddle.com for details of how to immerse yourself in the community. You can follow my adventures on Instagram at thenaturallifestylist. Big shout out to Simon from We Are The Clarks for producing, filming, editing. Much love.